to low 40s across the Midwest, while lows tonight will drop into the 20s. The forecast for East Central Illinois this afternoon, mostly sunny with a high of 37. The wind from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear, the low 25. The wind will be out of the southwest from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Saturday, sunny with a high around 40 and a southwest wind from 5 to 10 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly clear. We'll see a low in the upper 20s. The wind out of the southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Sunday, Christmas Day, sunny. Look for a high in the low 40s. The wind will be from the west at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to around 25 miles per hour. Sunday night, mostly clear with a low in the mid-20s. Monday, mostly sunny. It will be another day with a high in the low 40s. Monday night and Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-30s and the high Tuesday in the low 40s. At noon Central Time, Illinois and Indiana had a mix of clouds and sun. Temperatures in the 30s. At Rockford, 30 degrees, 33 at O'Hare. In Bloomington, 29. Mattoon, 35. In Carbondale, 37. At South Bend, 36. Lafayette, 37. Indianapolis and Terre Haute reported 38 degrees. It was cloudy at Willard Airport at the top of the hour. The temperature, 34. The dew point, 27. The relative humidity, 75%. The wind out of the west at 7, giving us a wind chill of 28. And the barometric pressure, 30.34 and falling. And at 12:39, 33 degrees in Urbana. A wasp uses a pebble as a hammer. An octopus carries around a coconut shell to hide in. A shrike impales its prey on a sharp thorn. Just three examples of animal tool use that appear in the new book, Animal Tool Behavior. In the 1960s, textbooks described humans as the only animals to use tools. That changed in the 70s when Jane Goodall observed chimpanzees making and using tools. This new book, Animal Tool Behavior, tries to catalog the full range of tool use in animals. NPR's John Hamilton visited the Indianapolis Zoo to speak with one of the authors.
I'm touring the exhibits with Rob Shoemaker. He's vice president for life sciences here and also teaches at Indiana University.
Well, we're approaching our polar bear exhibit, and we have this adult female tundra, and she is about as beautiful as a polar bear can be.
Shoemaker says one goal of the book, which he wrote with Benjamin Beck and Christina Walkup, is to correct some widespread misconceptions, like the idea that tool use is limited to monkeys and apes.
We have these great stories about polar bear tool use that are in the historical literature. And one of the stories we have is polar bears getting up on a cliff and hurling great chunks of ice down on something like a walrus to kill it.
While that's an anecdote, there's no doubt that polar bears in zoos often throw objects with great force and accuracy. Shoemaker says another common misconception is that tool use requires fingers, or at least hands. He says no one bothered to tell dolphins they couldn't use tools.
They're really, really remarkable. And to me, what's so interesting about dolphins is they have nothing to hold tools with except their mouth. And yet, they're still innovative and creative.
Shoemaker says dolphins play with just about any object they find. But in this context, the objects are just toys. Something becomes a tool when it's used to manipulate another object or creature for a specific purpose. Jody Baker is in charge of marine mammals. She says a dolphin named Chemo often manipulates people with a tool, a buoy.
While we were talking, Chemo was coming over here with it. I was wondering if he was going to throw it out. Typically, if you walk by the pool and there's a dolphin playing with a toy, they'll typically throw it in your direction to get your attention.
That's a form of tool use known as baiting or enticing. But Shoemaker says scientists have collected lots of other examples.
One is a dolphin that found a piece of tile, broken tile, and took it down to the bottom of their pool and used it to scrape algae off the bottom of the pool, and they ate the algae.
Shoemaker says you can also see tool use in wild dolphins, including some in Australia that flush out their prey with a sponge.
They hold the sponge on their rostrum And then they use that as they disturb the sandy bottom to get fish like flounder that are down in the sand.
One of the most widespread myths about tool use is that it's a sign of intelligence. Shoemaker says some really smart animals do use tools, but so do creatures like the bolus spider, which hunts with a weapon made from the same silk it uses to spin a web.
And when an insect flies by, they throw it, and it attaches to the insect because it's sticky, and they reel them in. It's very complex, very impressive, very dramatic, but all available information tells us that it's completely controlled from this animal's genetic history.
It's programmed behavior, not something the spider figured out. Genetic programming is also the reason hermit crabs carry around another creature's shell and antlions throw sand at their prey. Shoemaker says at the other end of the spectrum are highly intelligent animals that rarely use tools.
We're standing in front of this really lovely troop of ring-tailed lemurs.
These lemurs are not only smart, they have fingers and opposable thumbs.
You'd expect that they'd be pretty good tool users or pretty notable tool users, and in fact they're not.
When intelligent animals do use tools, though, they often do so in very creative ways.
So we are overlooking the main elephant exhibit.
Tim Littig is a senior elephant trainer.
This is Kubwa, 35-year-old Kubwa, and our latest baby, her latest calf, little Kalina, who's approaching about 7 weeks of age now.
Kalina has been able to nurse without any help. But Littig says things were trickier with Kubwa's previous baby.
Her last calf was a little smaller than this one and required a step stool to be able to reach her mammary glands to nurse. And Kubwa would move the stool around so the calf could stand up on the stool to nurse, reach to nurse.
Shoemaker says this sort of creative problem-solving with tools is a sign of intelligence. So is figuring out how to make a tool, a skill many scientists once thought of as uniquely human. Shoemaker says those scientists must not have spent much time around orangutans.
You do have to not go up too closely because they can reach out pretty far and they'll take your equipment.
Yeah, of course they would.
So, and your wallet. So.
Right, yes. Yeah.
Several of the zoo's orangutans make it clear they'd like to have the microphone I'm carrying. Shoemaker tells a female named Kenobi that she can touch it.
Nice soft microphone cover on that, but you cannot have the whole thing.
When I move beyond her reach, Kenobi fetches a small tree branch.
You're seeing Kenobi right now. There's some tool manufacturers. She's making a reaching tool to try and get your microphone.
Kenobi breaks off one fork of the branch so it will fit through the mesh around the enclosure. But the branch still isn't long enough, and she's determined.
Not too surprising. She now has a much bigger, stronger tool to come get the microphone. So she's gotten a full branch now.
And this reaching tool gets the job done.
So there you go. So she's doing her best to draw the mic in. No, we're not. I'm sorry, you cannot have it. Good job with your tool. Thank you for that. We got to publish that. Oh, wow. Now she's gone and got a much bigger, stronger branch. So we're going to leave now.
Just 10 or 15 years ago, scientists were still debating whether orangutans in the wild also made tools. Now it's clear they do. And so do other species. New Caledonian crows make hooks out of twigs to catch prey. Wild chimpanzees make wooden spears for hunting. Shoemaker says the most surprising and controversial findings in the new book involve so-called symbolic tools.
These are examples where we see tools being used to represent something else or to provide a change in psychological state.
One simple symbolic tool that we use all the time is money. And some monkeys and apes in captivity have learned to use tokens for a similar purpose. But Shoemaker is more intrigued by symbolic tools that can affect emotions. There are lots of examples in people. Children often have a special stuffed animal or blanket that is much more than a toy. The object represents comfort or security to them, and they use it to feel better. And in the past few years, Shoemaker says, scientists have been collecting evidence that some animals use symbolic tools in much the same way.
We would see great apes in times of great stress or sadness, like a female who had an infant that died, where that female would create something that researchers called a doll and then treated it exactly as she had treated her infant that had recently died.
Scientists are still debating the significance of examples like this. But Shoemaker says the fact that this debate is even taking place shows how much things have changed since the 1960s. That's when scientists first realized that humans weren't the only creatures using tools. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Few things announce the arrival of Christmas time like the sound of bells. And chances are many of the bells you hear this holiday season can be sourced to one small family-owned manufacturing business in East Hampton, Connecticut. Bevan Brothers was founded 180 years ago. Josephine Holtzman reports.
In its heyday, you might have called Bevan Brothers the rock star of the bell business. A Bevan bell once started and ended the day at the New York Stock Exchange, sat on the handlebar of the first bicycles, signaled the rounds of famous championship boxing matches, and sank with the American battleship Maine in the Spanish-American War. But maybe the most notable bell is the one from this holiday classic.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Yes, a Bevan bell gave Clarence his wings in It's a Wonderful Life. But today, the booming American bell business has gone quiet, almost. At the end of Bevan Road, one factory is still making sleigh bells for Christmas orders.
Yeah, it just has a wonderful sound to it. It just sounds like production.
Matt Bevan walks through the old factory like a proud parent.
This is a strap of sleigh bells here.
He rings bells and shows off the few massive machines that stamp, weld, and trim the bells that begin as a coil of metal that looks like a huge fruit by the foot. To him, this is hallowed ground.
Six generations of my family have walked across the same floor. I mean, every single Bevan has produced bells in this little corner of Connecticut.
Matt Bevan took over the company 3 years ago when his Uncle Stanley was ready to close the doors after 176 years of Bevan-run business. Matt was already running an investment management firm, but his stable career and bank account allowed him to take on the struggling family business as a labor of love.
Frankly, in an electronic day and age, who really needs a bell? I mean, you can probably replicate the sound of it with your phone, and yet there's something about them, the tangibility of them, the feel, the sound, the clang, that people do like.
Maria Stevens, a Bevan employee for 19 years, assembles bells for a local steam train.
I am actually crimping this together for a big order for Essex train.
Here, output is too low to invest in automation, so most detailed processes are still done by hand. Today, most young residents of East Hampton don't know why a roadside sign reads, "Welcome to Belltown." But Walter Olson, who was born here and worked at Bevan for 53 years, remembers well.
It was a real unique sound when the bells were going. Sound, you just can't duplicate it. It's